evening, I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then we consider what you know of the news of the day. Tonight we take a somber pause to reflect on the past month of conflict, turmoil and suffering in the Gaza Strip as the war there enters its second month. Now the consequences of this war has resonated far beyond the region, igniting debate over international diplomacy, the role of major powers, and the urgency of a humanitarian ceasefire. Joining us now, we have award-winning journalist and scholar James Dorsey. He's an honorary fellow at the National University of Singapore's Middle East Institute and an adjunct senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies. James, thank you so much for being on the show with me today. Over the past month, we have witnessed continued devastation in Gaza that has raised questions about global problem solving and the ability of the world to prevent atrocities such as this. I'm wondering from your perspective, what has the past month revealed to you about the state of the international system, the limitations that it might have in addressing conflicts and preventing humanitarian crises like the one we're seeing in Gaza now?
Thank you for having me. I think what we're seeing is a breakdown of the international system. And that has to do with issues that are far broader than the Middle East. The Middle East is just one factor in that. And in my mind, it has to do with that we've seen the rise of a critical mass of civilizationalist leaders. What I mean by that is leaders who think in terms of civilizational borders, not of national borders. And because of the breakdown, if you wish, or as part of the breakdown, are able to assert themselves that way. Take Russian President Vladimir Putin with the invasion of Ukraine, Xi Jinping of China with the South China Sea and Taiwan, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban with his notions of a Christian state that expands into Romania and other parts of Southeastern Europe, and of course, Benjamin Netanyahu, whose government sees certainly the West Bank as an integral part of Israel and clearly is reasserting within the last war claims, not civilizational claims, but security claims to Gaza. Now, the problem with here is that essentially the notions of hypocrisy and of double standards move increasingly to the forefront. I think a little bit what is forgotten is the United States takes a good deal of the blame for that, of course, and Europe certainly with regard to the current Gaza conflict. But the same Arab states that are justifiably calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and condemn Israel for its bombardments were silent or participants in a similar sort of massacre and slaughter over a decade in Syria.
Okay, so when we talk about where this war in Gaza is headed, despite calls for a UN-led calls for a humanitarian ceasefire, there seems to be no action or interest in that. So what happens now? Is there a role for international systems, international diplomacy to play in halting the violence in Gaza?
Of course there's a role. The problem with it is twofold. One symptom of the breakdown of the international system that a month into this war, the UN Security Council, which essentially sets international law, has been incapable of coming out with a resolution, whether that's because of the Russians or because of the United States. Fact is, it's impotent and paralyzed. Ultimately, diplomacy is the answer. But diplomacy is only going to start really work under one of two conditions. You apply pressure, which none of the parties have been willing to do or able to do, to be fair. there are not that many parties. It's really a handful that can apply some sort of pressure or influence in this conflict. Or you do the right thing, which is put the lives of innocent people as the priority, rather than your collective, you know, state interests and what you think is going to serve your purpose well, no matter how many people die in the process.
Well, the stated purpose of Israel is to end Hamas's rule in Gaza, destroy its military capability. But what have the events of the past month revealed to you about Israel's endgame for Gaza or exit strategy in this Gaza invasion?
Well, first of all, before I come to the end game, let's keep one thing in mind. Sure, what the context matters, but what context does, it explains. It does not justify. So I think what increasingly is lost in the discussion, and I understand why, but nonetheless, is the fact that this started with a brutal attack on Israel that was not focused on the Israeli military. It was focused on the killing of innocent civilians. And there's no state that cannot respond to that. Now, the problem with that is that the Israeli response is not going to help a resolution. It's probably going to aggravate things. But both Israel and Hamas have a responsibility in this. In terms of what the Israeli endgame is, we don't know. And it's not clear that the Israelis know, and or if they know, they're only willing to lift the veil on bits and pieces rather than declare a clear end strategy. So what we know right now is Israel wants to destroy Hamas. Whether or not physical destruction of Hamas, with other words, the destruction of its infrastructure in Gaza, the killing or capture of its senior and middle leadership is going to mean that Hamas is destroyed, we don't know. And one could argue that that may not be the case. The second thing we know is that Israel has now said, the Israeli prime minister yesterday, that Israel will have a continued security role indefinitely in Gaza. And we're not quite clear what that means. I think we can be fairly sure that what Israel does not want is to have to administer Gaza on a day-to-day basis. So if it doesn't want to do that, what happens in Gaza? And there are various alternatives, ranging from some homegrown Palestinian leadership that is not Hamas that would govern Gaza. There's no way that anyone will want to do that on the back of an Israeli tank. The Palestine Authority taking over control of the Gaza Strip. Again, the authority, President Mahmoud Abbas, will not want to do that if it is not linked to a real effort to resolve definitively the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and certainly will not want to do that if Hamas survives this war, or the Israelis take control of a wasteland that has been depopulated. Now, there are thoughts within the Israeli government about that and that favor that, but it is not articulated Israeli government policy.
Okay, James, thank you for joining us on the show tonight and shedding your insights on the matter. James Dorsey, adjunct senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies, Appreciate your time. We'll be right back here on Consider This. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. As the war in Gaza enters its second month, we are also witnessing another battlefield, the arena of language, where words and narratives are powerful weapons and used as such. Joining us now to explain how and why words matter, especially in times of war, we have Associate Professor Dr. Narita Omar. She's from the Faculty of Modern Languages and Communication at UPM. Dr. Narita, thank you for being on the show with me today. You know, language can be a weapon all of its own, especially potent in times of conflict. I'm wondering whether you can begin our conversation by helping us understand how language can shape perception, can shape attitudes, and the way we respond, especially as to respond to what has been happening in Gaza in the past month.
Thank you, Melissa, for the invitation and question there. I would like to start that for many years that we have depended on the mainstream media. See, so what we're saying here is the construction of what is already inherent narratives in society in terms of how we look at certain things. So one of the things that, as you mentioned, the idea of framing the conflict in relation to the issue on Palestine, the language that we use, what is in the mass media, in relation to the traditional media and also the alternative media, social media especially, what we have to be alert is the idea of the notion of dehumanization that we are playing out. The concept of drip in mass media, drip, you know, little by little, the construction of a certain image will be projected based on words that we have developed or constructed through certain issues that we are passionate about. So in this case, particularly in Malaysia, for example, or the whole world, that we are disturbed by the idea of dehumanizing of subject in relation to the conflict that we are faced with. So dehumanization, as we see, is the reference to making subject or individual or group of people as less human, or in stereotyping, in causing certain conflict, for example, or they are just a group of people homogenizing all, for example, all Arabs are the same. So this is an ongoing discourse in the media, for example, in mainstream media. We're not talking it. So what we're seeing now is the counter narrative we're seeing counter narratives to what the mainstream media has constructed. So words such
as... Sorry, Dr. Rita, if I may just jump in here very quickly. So when you talk about dehumanizing language in the context of the war in Gaza right now, mm-hmm. who is being dehumanized? Who is doing the dehumanizing to whom? And what do you mean? Can you give us examples of what dehumanizing language is?
Okay, the reports that we read, newspaper articles or news channel, for example, whether on television or in printed news, that we see this is this is what we, the humanizing is the way we actually use certain words, you know. For example, we capture, for example, the word terrorist, for example, throughout, you know, throughout our, or the war itself, you know, attack, for example, the word attack, who's attacking? Another thing is that who's attacking, who's the perpetrator, for example, all of these is going to be a biased picture that we bring in without us consciously or unconsciously writing or talking about this.
Right. So I have noticed also in the coverage that we've been seeing in mainstream media, particularly mainstream media of the West, the linguistic bias that you've mentioned, right? The different sides frame it in one way. One side dies, the other side is killed. Every side has its own lexicon. I am wondering, what is the harm? What harm does it perpetuate when dehumanizing language is used in coverage of a conflict?
Well, one of the things is it will cause emotional impact, in other words, that, and also public opinion in terms of how they see. So the escalation of the conflict, for example, perhaps I would say that it is really significant in terms of how we describe the perpetrator, for example, or Israeli, for example, are the subject in terms of being the perpetrator.
Okay. Can I ask you, when individuals are consuming news during these times, these fraught times, what do you tell people to look out for, to be more critical consumers of media coverage, particularly in the context of the war in Gaza?
Well, we have to look at the generalization, you know, homogenizing, for example, in relation of terminology that we use, aggressive language we use, objectification, terms of statistics, for example, even numbers, you know. We have faceless numbers, for example. Recently, I saw on there's at Washington, D.C., for example, they are reading the names of the kids. So to give that understanding, these are not faceless individuals. So what happened in the news, we are giving number of deaths, for example, you know, 10,000 deaths that we have. So as if that the statistics doesn't mean a thing. So we have to be very careful on concentrating on number of deaths, for example, rather than, you know, it's a personal narrative. And as I said, for example, Palestine is a very personal thing to me because I have someone who's so close to me, a PhD graduate, who I'm on constant contact with him. So worrying about him and his family. So in other words, that someone must know these people. You know, in other words, that we cannot just say that these are, you know, there are 800 deaths today, for example. So we have to be careful. In that sense, we are dehumanizing this context of people that we don't know. So that could be something that we must be aware of.
That every number or statistic that's reported, that's a person with hopes and dreams and aspirations. And I think a number kind of dehumanizes. Yeah. Desensitizes the reader to that. What about social media, Doctor? Social media plays a huge role in the way we consume news nowadays, in the way information is being disseminated. How does the dehumanizing language spread through social media? And are you concerned about dehumanizing language slipping off the internet into real life? Because right now, we're seeing a rise in anti-Semitism, in Islamophobia. The ground is fertile for hate. Yeah. How do you approach consumption of news of Gaza on social media?
You are right. The what is happening in the social media could actually leak into the outside, you know, outside of media. So the thoughts, the behavior, for example, could actually influence the way we're seeing things. I think social media is really sort of increasing or the conflict sort of is heightened by the way people are responding to it, you know, through social media. Sometimes misinformation, so unverified information, for example, can be quite dangerous in that sense that we need to be aware of. So we are shaping, for example, this is a reciprocal thing, where the way the world is shaped through media and how media shape people in that sense. So it's a two-way thing, you know, that we're shaping the media and the reality of our life. Yeah.
You mentioned misinformation, Dr. Yeah. Narita. How concerning is the issue of misinformation and disinformation in the conflict, in the past 1 month that we've seen this conflict escalate?
There are quite a number. I think ABC News have actually covered a list of misinformation being done in relation to, for example, a Yemeni general, for example, who actually, they said that Yemen is already ready to go to war, to attack Israel. That is actually a fact check by them. It's not. So, for example, there are many other viral news that need to be checked before people get emotional about it and causing certain action, which is unnecessary in terms of the way we think about this conflict.
Mm. What do we do if we come across dehumanizing language being used in the media that we consume? What should we do about that?
Well, you can see we can see, for example, the netizens are responding to it. We call it counter narratives. For example, this is what I see: counter narratives. You're telling again what, for example, one of the things. The counter narrative is best done by the grassroots narrative that are the Palestinian themselves or the subject that in, you know, instead of. So you have to double check, for example, that it's not something that you must accept rather than check in terms of what is the story about.
Is this something that's typical to all conflicts, Dr. Dorita? Is this specific to this very divisive issue of Palestine and Israel? Is this specific to this context, or do we see the weaponization of dehumanizing language in almost every conflict around the world?
I think that is the principle in terms of dehumanization, because Edward Said mentioned that it started with the notion of Orientalism, as I mentioned to you earlier. So the idea of looking at the East, for example, so this is between us and them. So it's already in the discourse, us and them, you know, the West and the East, for example, South and North. The dichotomy of these, for example, is difficult for us to get out of it, and so it's not just the Palestinian. Particularly when we see conflict, for example, any conflict, for example, or you mentioned Islamophobia, that is a start of how we look at the East, the Muslim, you know. So the same thing, anti-Semitism, for example, how the Jews are being looked at. So one that we forget I like to come back when you say how do you counter back in terms of dehumanization, probably the best word is to, we call it humanization. So that is the act of looking at, you know, things in a better perspective, you know, instead of looking negatively at it, or describing it in terms of it being evil, for example. I'm not saying that war, for example, you say war is evil, you know, of course, I mean, I'm not saying that to humanize war, for example, but we have to be more empathic in that sense, you know, sympathetic in terms of describing, you know, we don't want, you know, the bias get to us in terms of
right.
serve us, not to serve humanity. So we have to think of humanity rather than a biased picture that, you know, for example, I must think of myself. No, we have to think what others think too.
Right, to practice empathy and our humanity. Thank you, Dr. Norita, for your time. That was Dr. Norita Omar from UPM wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.